Hello everyone, and welcome to the fourth episode of Build Your Future podcast. Today I'm here with Michael Primrose, the founder and director of the Property Finance Collective. Welcome, Michael Primrose.
Hello mate, thank you very much for having me on.
Yeah, pleasure. So what I like to do at the beginning of these podcasts is just kind of take a bit more of a deep dive into somebody's background, how kind of it all started, just kind of gives the audience a bit of context as to who they are, what they're about, and then after that we'll kind of transition into what you're currently actively working on, and then we'll go through kind of a few deals and a bit more knowledge around kind of commercial finance, really.
Yeah, so I started off in commercial finance about, well, it was just as my daughter was born, so it must be 6 years ago. So been in commercial finance for 6 years, 4 years sort of as my own entity. So started off as a property finance guy, went off and hired a load of people, and large majority of those were female. So obviously having a company called the Property Finance Guy and having majority female staffing base didn't really work, so we had to go to the Property Finance Collective, hence the rebrand. But I come from I've always been in property. Everything I've ever done has always been in property. So left school, went straight into conveyancing, which was probably the most boring thing I've ever done. It was just paperwork literally all the time, just the same paperwork every time. No 2 days were different. It was just literally the most mundane thing I've ever done. Then got into a state agency, which was no better. It was just as bad. Stupidly went back into conveyancing, got made redundant, and went, I can't do this anymore. I've got to find something else, like something more entertaining that just engages my brain in some way. So I was 22 at that point, I think. And literally just stumbled across commercial finance. I had no interest in commercial finance whatsoever. It wasn't like I went to uni and studied anything finance related or anything like that. Just literally stumbled into it as a sales job, and yeah, just loved it the second I got into it. Just absolutely loved it. And it initially started off as business finance and then moved into property finance, but yeah, just absolutely fell in love with it, and hence wanted to start my own thing and kind of move on and do my own thing with it. And yeah, we're literally 4 years, I'm just looking at the date, 4 years, a couple of days ago. So we've done fairly well, to be fair. Managed to keep
going. Wow, congratulations.
So yeah, it's been...
That's really good. I mean, you've lost our estate agent and our conveyancing listeners already. So
yeah, straight away. That's, yeah, they've got...
Well, no, it was interesting to kind of hear how you kind of stepped straight into property. A lot of people kind of go through a certain career, go to university, then do one or two things, and then they kind of then pursue property as a bit of a side business, a side hustle, and then maybe that then extends into going into it full time. Well, you've always obviously had an interest in property. Has that been from family or friends, or where did that kind of steer come from?
Honestly, no idea. So it didn't come from, there was no steer from family, there was no steer from friends, there was no desire in my head that I wanted to go and do property or anything like that. I was working in McDonald's, actually, funny enough, when I left school. And so I left sixth form, had a place at university to study, I think it was crime scene forensics was what I'd gone for. So to go and be a scene of crime officer at London Metropolitan. So that's what I had an unconditional offer from London Metropolitan University. Literally bags were packed, finance was applied for, everything else. And like was working the last couple of days notice at McDonald's, and got an email from an old school tutor who said, oh, there's this job role that's come up, an apprenticeship. It's like £400 a month or something stupid, I think it was. Do you want to go for it? And I was like, oh, I love the idea of being a lawyer. That's how it was put across. It was like, here's this apprenticeship to go and be a lawyer. And it was all this kind of drama stuff around it that you see all of these TV programs. It just makes being a lawyer look so sexy. And I thought, yeah, I'm going to go for this. I'm going to go and have a look. I'm going to go see, what have I got to lose? Like, I hadn't quit the uni place or anything like that. Went and kind of had the interview, and they said, yeah, like, we'll offer you the job. And I said, okay, great. Yeah, well, what am I going to be doing? And they said, oh, we'll start you off in conveyancing, because that's kind of like a good entry position to start off in. No idea what that meant. Had no idea it was anything to do with property. I thought it was actually more wills and probates. I got there the first day and was like, all right, I'm going to be dealing with essentially like deceased estates. And then, yeah, just ended up building up from there. And that's, so I even fell into property accidentally, really.
Okay.
Every time I do property, I fall into it accidentally.
Like, again, I find a lot of people again, there's different routes, isn't there? And some people just fall into it, as you've kind of done there. So you were what when you first stumbled into it? So you left sixth form.
18.
So you would have been what, 18, 19?
Yeah, 18 when I first started, yeah. So 10 years okay. in and so, property-related stuff now.
And then how long did you do the estate agency for before you kind of realised that wasn't for you as well?
Oh, about 9 months. I think that was all I could muster in the end. It was just, it's such a... Well, I found it to be such a snaky industry.
Yeah.
All of these kind of brown paper envelopes. Oh, yeah, we'll take that deal off you, yeah. And just, I don't know, I just wasn't a massive fan of it. And I worked in an office with two ladies who were, how to put this delicately, very friendly with one another and didn't like the fact that someone else had come into this lovely setup that they had. There was literally two people in this office and they were the only two that worked there. And I think they'd gotten away with a lot of stuff, didn't really do a huge amount of work. And then I came in and was like, all right, okay, yeah, cool. So what are we doing? What are we working on? And I knew one of the partners who worked there from kind of my conveyancing time before. And I think he kind of used me as a way to find out how little work they were doing. So yeah, about 9 months.
Oh, so you were the one being a snake.
Well, yeah, essentially, when I started off and said it was a snakey industry, basically what I mean is I went in and was just a massive snake straight away. and was just throwing two ladies under the bus. But yeah, 9 months was all I could muster in a state agency before I just...
I asked because, yeah, I was kind of interested whether it was... because it was kind of a cutthroat business or if it kind of was the monotony of doing the same viewings, dealing with kind of the same clients or was it, again, as you kind of said there, in terms of I've seen it in sales before where when a new salesperson comes in, sometimes the internal staff see it as kind of a, this is another mouth to feed and these are my clients, stay away from them and this is my, you know, deal, stay away from this sort of thing. And people can get quite kind of protective over certain deals because obviously that's where the commission comes from, so you can kind of understand it, but I think that kind of causes quite a cutthroat industry sometimes,
big time. And yeah, I mean I loved putting the deals together. That was and kind of why commercial finance has been sort of a bit of a calling, I think, was actually putting the deals together, doing the structure, getting everything kind of in place and moving forward. And yeah, I loved that side of things. But yeah, the actual day-to-day running of the business and just the environment that I was in was just not ideal at all. And I've always been told that I'm unemployable as well. So it's always quite nice to run your own business when you're unemployable.
Absolutely. As long as they're saying that for good reasons and not bad ones.
Yeah, I got a feeling it probably wasn't all positive, but yeah, it's just one of those things. If you find yourself unemployable, the best thing to do is start a business.
No, well, I guess that's a nice segue for us then. So stepping into the finance side of things, so obviously you worked for another company before setting up your own one.
Yeah.
What was kind of the amount of time that you did that for and your experience around that, and then kind of what made or motivated you to then set up your own business? And then we can kind of talk about the growth pains about setting up your own business and dealing with internal staff. And what I find interesting is people kind of set up a business because they have this kind of entrepreneurial mindset and they want to be independent and everything else. But then as that business grows and scales, they then need to take on staff. And actually, it can sometimes take away from the entrepreneurial side and the reason why you started the business in the first place, because sometimes you can end up spending more time dealing with internal politics and, you know, training and interviewing, etc., then actually getting stuck into the thick of it for the reasons why you set up in the first place.
Absolutely. So, I started off, so I must have been there for about 18 months to 2 years, the company I sort of first started at. And what I loved it there, it was great. I had a really, really positive experience and learned a lot of stuff, actually, about a number of different things. So there was a huge benefit of doing that, and I don't regret spending that 18 months, 2 years there at all. In terms of kind of why I decided to go on my own, there was a couple of reasons, actually. The first one was I actually decided I wanted to go into kind of doing my own development. So I'd done 18 months, 2 years of helping people finance their own stuff, and I thought, you know what, I want to get into my own stuff. I thought, I'm going to take a risk. I was young enough, stupid enough to be able to take that risk. So at that point I went, yeah, right, come on, let's leave this. Let's go set up our developed company. Let's get a couple of deals going. And then let's kind of see what spiral from there. as everything always does with property, had this great deal that I went to go and basically get started with, got a really long way down the line, spent quite a bit of cash, and unfortunately it fell down when we got to surveys and everything else and found that we were going to have to put, I think it was about 200 or 300 mil of fill on top of the site because of issues with the ground. Just blew the numbers way out of proportion for making it stack, because these were big executive houses. They were going to be a risk anyway. And it was a big old site to go and basically do all of this maneuvering around to get everything sorted. So at that point, I kind of had to assess my options and go, right, do I... And this was probably 3 or 4 months after I'd left. So at this point, money's getting tight, starting to worry about, okay, where's the next paycheck coming from? And it was at that point that I sat and thought, right, okay, I'm going to have to come up with something. So I partnered with a couple of guys to go and do this development. We were looking at some other developments as well. And we just got to talking and thought, well, actually, you guys have got a skill set of being able to go and find developers, being able to find private investors, everything else. I've got the skill set again to be able to finance commercial deals and be able to find development finance, bridging finance, that kind of thing. Let's think about setting up some sort of business together. So three of us set up our own little brokerage. That lasted about 9 months before we had probably what I would call creative differences. I wanted to go in one direction, they wanted to go in another. It's basically a polite way of saying the JV just fell apart, basically. And it was at that point that I decided, right, I'm going to have to go do my own thing. I need to be fully in control of something. I think that was a lesson that I'd learned from being employed as well, was I needed that element of control, of being able to be in control of it all and being able to be in control of where things were going, the direction of the company, everything else. And being employed, you can't do that. Being in a JV with two other people, because they were already in an existing partnership, I was coming into that. So I was outvoted on everything instantly. There was no negotiation or anything like that. It was like I had one vote versus two all the time. So yeah, it was a case of going, right, okay, I need to be fully in control, 100% control. I decide where everything's going, the direction, everything else. And yeah, I was sat there. So my second daughter had been born at this point. It was literally a couple of days after she was born. I was sat there and my wife and me were talking about it and going, right, okay, we're seriously struggling for cash here. Like, what are we going to do? And it was to the point where we started borrowing money from friends, family, and everything else. And we're sat there and like, right, okay, we need to sort something out. And it was like, right, I'm going to have to go find a job. I'm going to have to do temp work, all this kind of thing. And I think at that point, I went and did a little bit of temp work with Coca-Cola on sales, like just on their phone lines and stuff, just trying to get enough money to live, basically. And I remember being sat at the dining table and we were talking about, right, okay, what are we going to go do? And I got this email in from a guy who was hosting PPN Leeds, I think it was. Oh, can you come to a talk? He still thought that I was with these guys basically doing the... still doing the JV that we had. It was, oh, can you come to a talk? Come talk about commercial finance. Come talk about kind of what you can do. Went down and he introduced me on stage as the property finance guy. And I was like, that's got a ring to it. I like that. Like I can steal that. That's mine. And I've always credited him with like, you came up with a name for this. But yeah, it was just from there, like just a light bulb went off and it was like, that's it. Property finance guy. That's what it's going to be. That's what we're going to go for. And yeah, ran that for nearly 2 years before we then decided to switch the name.
That's interesting that you said that you then went and started the property finance guy, because you said that, you know, you were doing some temp work and you needed money, but then starting up a business takes its time, building a client base takes its time,
yeah,
kind of getting the finance in place and then getting that money in. I don't know the times, because obviously you guys get kind of commission usually two ends, isn't it? You kind of get some from the client sometimes and then equally you get some from placing them with the actual finance, correct?
For us, it's so all back-ended, yeah.
Okay, it's all back-end. So then that, what sort of lead times is that, when that usually comes into play? Because all these things I'm thinking obviously takes time for it to come in. So were there kind of concerns about that time in between, or were you kind of excited to kind of get going and kind of, I guess, start the process?
Yeah, so I was really, really lucky, actually, that I started the business on the 9th of November, I think it was when it all got registered with Companies House. And by the end of November, we'd cleared, I think, $3,000 or $4,000 in fees. Like, we had some really quick deals going complete. And for me, that was like the biggest paycheck of any month that I'd ever had. Like, net, this money is ours to kind of deal with. So from that perspective, yeah, I was just super excited to get in. We had enough money to see us through November because of the temp work and stuff like that. And it was just a case of like, right, we need some cash in. And yeah, November was great. December then ended up getting a private investor on board who came in and invested in the company, put a bit of cash in, and that kind of then saw us through to early, I think it was 2019 at that point then. So early 2019, absolutely flying, paid back the private investor. I mean, he was meant to be in for like a couple of years. He was in for a couple of months. Paid him back, he was gone. And then at that point, yeah, we've absolutely flown ever since, really.
Nice. So, property finance guy obviously flew off for the next two years. What made you make the decision then to, going back to kind of my previous question, to scale that and start taking staff on, opposed to you kind of just being content and happy, you being the face of it, the brand, and kind of doing it as a solo entity?
Yeah, so the biggest thing for me was I just genuinely couldn't cope with the level of business that was coming in. And I kind of got it in my head. So I joined a couple of masterminds, got involved with a few people and kind of took advice from them around scaling and whatnot. And I wouldn't call it a mistake, because there's no such thing as a mistake in business. I don't think everything's a lesson, isn't it? But one of my biggest mistakes was that I definitely scaled too quickly. Like, we went mental. And at the end of 2019, we got up to, I think it was about 13 members of staff. So it went from literally just me on my own to there was like 13 of us. And I sat there at the start of 2020, obviously this was just before COVID hit, and we just didn't have enough to give people. Like, it had gone, there was too much for me, so I needed a couple of other people's help out, that was fine. But then it was like, okay, well, let's take on some marketing people. Or, well, let's not just take on one marketing, let's take on two marketing. And then it was, okay, well, if this marketing takes off, we need more admin, let's take on two more admin. And then it's like, oh, we need an office manager. Oh, well, we need a couple of apprentices as well. And it just got silly. And it was to the point where at the start of 2020 there was about 13 of us. And we were quite lucky to a degree that at the start of 2020, so before COVID hit, a few people decided to head off. So we kind of cut our staffing base down naturally. They wanted to go and explore other stuff. We then lost a few people during COVID as well, because it's weird how when people had all this time at home, not working, all of a sudden their brain opens up and they go, well, actually, I want to go do this. So we had one person leave who wanted to go become a teacher. We had one person leave who wanted to go into accountancy. So it was like another two member staff moved on as well. So then coming out of COVID, we probably got the staff base down to like six or seven. And I sat there and I was like, this is still too much. Like, I'd kind of done the scaling thing. And I was like, all it does is, with scaling for us, for commercial finance especially, I think you can scale it to whatever size you want. Your overhead gets bigger, but your bottom line doesn't get any bigger. And it's kind of, it's that thing of, there's only a certain number of clients you're ever going to get. You can be the biggest commercial finance brokerage in the world. There's only going to be a finite number of clients that come to you as opposed to everyone else. The competition is just insane. So what we found is we still like six, seven of us. And it was like, this is still too many. Like, we're still paying out 15, 20 grand a month on wages, overheads, everything else. We had the big office, we had everything else. So coming out of the back of COVID, we made a real decision, like, we need to scale this down. Like, we need to get it back down to being as profitable as possible. So, then decided to kind of, a couple of people actually naturally moved on, and there was only four of us left. No, there's five of us. So there's four of us and one marketing left. And then we decided to part ways with marketing early 2022. And then there was four of us, and it was like, you know what? The four of us are just going to become four shareholders. So everyone took shares. And I went, you know what? Yes, I want to be fully in control of this, but I need this kind of support network still around me. So one came on with like 35% shares, and then two others came on at five each. So I've still got the majority share of the company, and it's still kind of my decision what happens moving forward. But it's nice knowing that I've got a team of four of us. The business is profitable. It's now what I would call a cash cow. It's kind of, we've really, really drilled down. We haven't got the big fancy office anymore. We haven't got the massive overheads or anything like that. So from my perspective, actually, I'm kind of the opposite of this scaling up mentality. I'm actually now more of like a, let's scale this down. Let's cut cost wherever we can. Let's shop around for indemnity insurance. Let's shop around for business insurance, all this other stuff that we need to pay out for. So for us, like we went through that scaling up pain, and we're now going through actually the pain in reverse of trying to reverse all those stupid decisions, basically. And I would call it that they were stupid decisions. To go to 13 members of staff was ludicrous. The pay packet every month was just stupid. Like seeing that amount of money leave the business and the money that was coming in then is no different to what's coming in now. But now I'm like,
it must have been a lot of pressure back then as well, where you have a lot of mouths to feed and you kind of think,
oh, insane,
we need this money coming in, and then you feel that pressure, and then perhaps your own mindset and things change while you're kind of dealing with the stress and pressure of these people that you've got to support. So you feel this obligation, right? They've put their trust in you. They've come over to join you in your company. They've left their previous role or what have you. And you feel to some degree you need to deliver to support them and their livelihoods, and they might have kids and all these things. So it must be quite stressful in that remark. So what sort of impact, I know that obviously we spoke a little bit about COVID there as well, was that quite a scary time for you guys where you were kind of growing and scaling this business and then kind of boom, overnight things just got put on hold? I know obviously a lot of sites, people just weren't allowed to go on site, and that got, we all got put into lockdown, and I can't remember how long we weren't allowed on site for. I think it was around 3 months from memory. Obviously all that time put that pause and that delay, then I can imagine a lot of lenders freaked out and funding might have been pulled. And so there must have been quite of a chaotic time for you guys. So interested to hear a little bit more about that, really.
Yeah, I mean, it was completely unexpected. I mean, we ran an event at the start of March 2022. We had 151 people in the room, and I was like, this is mega.
I remember that. That was at London Bridge, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, so we had it at the old nightclub down in London. And yeah, we had this incredible event, and I loved it, every second of it. And I thought, yeah, this is the start of like a proper trajectory. We're going to do some stuff here. And then 2 weeks later, it was like COVID, boom, end of. Lenders are pulling out left, right, and center. All your deals that were in the pipeline have closed. All the lenders, solicitors have had to start working from home. There's 6 month delays on everything. Yeah, it was tough, really tough. My son was born in January 2020. And so we had a newborn baby at that point, literally, 3 months old. And to say that COVID period broke me is probably the understatement of the century. I mean, anyone who follows me on social media or anything will notice pretty much from COVID, I vanished, like completely just disappeared. No more videos, the podcast died, like everything just went, because there was this huge loss of confidence. And like you said, there was so much stress and so much pressure that everyone had to get paid and everything else. Because yes, there was still the 80% coverage of salaries and everything else, but it was still that, well, how am I going to get paid? Like, how am I going to cover my salaries and stuff? Because I couldn't go on furlough because I had to be working, I had to still be bringing business in. And yeah, the amount of pressure was just insane. But we got through it just about, and obviously as everyone else did, like utilized the bounce back loan, used it in the right way, and ensured that was kind of kept us afloat. But yeah, from a personal perspective, that destroyed me. Like all of my confidence went out the window in terms of what we could deliver. And probably, I would say during that 18-month, probably was 12, 18 months, built up this massive imposter syndrome, which still to this day, it like hasn't shifted. And yeah, it's been really, really difficult to get out of the back of that. And I think a lot of people don't realize that coming out the end of COVID, they didn't see the effects that it had on business owners and people like that who had gone through this massive stress of trying to keep everything afloat and losing everything that they had. And I think, yeah, the after effects of that still, even now, like 12, 18 months later, are still pretty raw. And yeah, like I say, all the social media stuff has died, and it's so difficult for me to get that confidence back now to be like, right, I can go and deliver this stuff. I can't remember the last time I did any public speaking. So going from running an event and literally doing all of this stuff in early 2020, to now literally doing nothing, that was the biggest impact out of COVID, 100%.
Mm. Yeah, I can imagine you're kind of at the peak, essentially. You've got this team around you, you're doing these speaking gigs, and things are looking to grow and scale, and you've kind of got this really real excitement and buzz, and then boom, kind of COVID comes and a lot of these things disappear overnight. And it sounds like you're obviously had a very tough time throughout that. And my parents own their own business, and I know that, so I kind of see it firsthand, the impact of what COVID had on kind of small companies. And I know obviously a few of our friends had impacts with these, with COVID and the impact that kind of brought with it as well. But I truly believe that these tough times make strong people. And as you've kind of said on the back end of that now you've kind of realized that actually 13 people was too many, and you were able to scale that down to 4 people. And then equally you found that loyalty and that support network was key. So you gave them the shareholders and that sort of percentage, and again you have to build this trust and this loyalty. And now you're saying you've now kind of got this cash cow where it's this strong business model where you've now got your key consistent team around you, and then you've got this nice kind of deal pipeline coming through as well. So I think you've done it. Obviously it's a learning experience, and some parts that you found tough, and again, like the office, for instance, it's nice to have the big shiny office, but do you actually need it? Well, no, let's stay lean. Sometimes, and Will Stokes spoke about this the other day, you know, business doesn't or isn't sexy, and it's very easy to kind of think, oh, you know, I want this, I want that, and you want it to look as good and sexy as possible, kind of get that Instagram approach. But actually, you find that the most successful people are the ones getting their head down and don't really care and focus on the bottom line and being lean as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. I think that's, it was a tough lesson to learn, to go from, literally being at the peak of the mountain and being like, right, we've got the opportunity to be one of the biggest sort of commercial finance brokerages, like the independent ones, to literally like this leg sweep of COVID, of being like, right, you've got to pretty much start all over again. It's been a massive, massive learning curve. But I have no doubt that we'll come back and, take that market share back, hopefully.
Good on you. I find the strength is that bounce back, right? And it's kind of adage of get knocked down 6 times, get up 7 or what have you. And it's exactly that. And things are going to happen along the way. And obviously this has been quite a shit situation for many people, but it's that ability to bounce back. And do you kind of give up and roll over, or do you kind of stay in the fight and say, no, we're going to power through this? And that sounds exactly what you've done.
Yeah. And that's it. Trying to keep that level of that level headedness, actually, is probably the best way to think. And just trying to now keep it where we are, not get too overexcited, not get too, right, let's go build all this back up again. And like I said, we're getting up that 7th time, just hopefully we'll keep our foot in the door for that bit longer, because I want to see a 5th year, a 6th year, a 7th year. We've done 4 years now. That for me is a huge achievement, and I want to see another 4. I'll keep getting up, there's no doubt about that.
Good man. It's all about having that long-term focus. And my mindset shifted in this as well, where I think in a world these days of instant gratification, it's easy to pull up Netflix and get everything straight away. It's easy to pull up Amazon and have a parcel delivered to your house that afternoon. And I find that a lot of people are so used to this instant gratification now that when things kind of go wrong, it's easy to throw in the towel. But actually, my mindset's now shifted of, no, I look at everything as a 5-year plan or a 10-year plan. And am I, what I'm doing right now, is that a vote for the 5-year version of me? Yeah. And so I think it's a good way to continue to look to the future and progress, because again, it goes back to what you're saying earlier of the look at me now with the 13 employees and the nice office and this, that, and the other. And it's like, okay, but if you were to continue down that path, who knows, it could have gone tits up in a year's time because of those overheads could have killed you. But now you're like, okay, we're not as sexy, but we're here and we're going to be here for the next 10, 15, 20 years. So who's the real winner?
Well, exactly. And that's the thing is, had I kept those 13 employees, and they all moved on for great reasons. I mean, I've never had to put, I think I've only ever gotten rid of one member of staff. So, I mean, that's not too bad out of the 13. I would much rather people move on themselves and kind of find their own destinies, much like I did. But had I kept 13 employees, there's absolutely no way. Come the start, we never would have survived COVID, without a shadow of a doubt, had we not lost some people in the January, February. Like that was an absolute godsend. At the time, devastating to lose any member of staff. And you always look at it as, oh, it's my fault, I've done something wrong, blah, blah, blah. But actually everything happens for a reason, and had those members of staff not moved on, absolutely at the start of COVID, we'd have been wiped out, without a shadow of a doubt. Losing those members of staff was, in the nicest way, a blessing for us. And they went on to other stuff, and they've all been very, very successful. But from our perspective, it was such a blessing to get that wage run down just before COVID hit. And obviously, like I say, it was a completely unpredictable thing. But yeah, at the time, it seems like the worst thing in the world. But in hindsight, actually, it was what saved us. Really was.
There you go. Sometimes these things are just meant to be. So now Absolutely. You've obviously gone through that. You've bounced back. You sound like you're in a good place, and the business is in a good place, and things look like they're back on the up, which is all really positive. So are you now kind of getting stuck back in? Are you looking at your own deals? Is there anything that you're currently working on?
Yeah. So at the minute, I mean, in terms of getting stuck back in, I'll have to get myself back on the old marketing train at some point and start getting out public speaking. But a lot of my time at the minute is taken up with obviously structuring client deals that are coming in, and we're working on some pretty meaty deals for clients at the minute, which have come from sort of some of the stuff we did a couple of years ago. But in terms of personally, so we've got one deal in particular at the minute for 40 units that we're looking at, which a client came to me and said, oh, I've got this deal that I want to bridge on. After kind of going through his assets and liabilities and everything else, it was like, well, actually, you don't want to bridge on this, you want to bridge on something else, which kind of left this land unencumbered. And we got to talking about it and kind of came up with, he didn't want a building out. They're contractors themselves. So for them, it's kind of like they don't want to be the developer. They want to be the contractor. They want that profit from that side. They don't want the risk of selling and everything else. So it kind of opened the door to a perfect JV, basically. So we've negotiated what, in my opinion, is quite a nice deal, whereby we kind of go into a 50-50. They're going to do all of the build out, fixed price, and they're going to do it at what they would had they retained the land themselves. And then we're going to exit out the back end, split everything 50-50. Obviously, I'll raise the development finance as well, so I get paid on the development finance. They get paid as a contractor, so we're kind of both mutually benefiting. They're not taking anywhere near what they would normally take if they were going to obviously build it out themselves. So yeah, we're just going through some amended planning at the minute. We're trying to take it from 40 units to 42 units. Because what there is there's essentially a block of land, and then there's a little house, and that house is ripe to be knocked down and put two units on there. Or there's the alternative of keeping that house and building two units to the front. So it'll end up being 42 or 43 units, which I think comes out with a GDV of about 10.5, although I think that's moving more to kind of 11 mil now, I think, with kind of obviously shifting prices and everything else. And hopefully as build costs come down, by the time we're ready to do this, we're probably talking middle of next year. By that time, hopefully things will have settled down a bit, and hopefully, fingers crossed, like material costs and stuff will have come down as well. So from that perspective, that hopefully will be a life-changing deal. And I'm set to make probably £1 million out of that deal. But it's going to appear kind of middle of 2023, looking at the years now, middle of 2024 probably. So it's a really long burn. But yeah, from the commercial finance side, we've never been busier in terms of what's coming through at the minute, and in terms of debt quantum as well. Like everyone's running around going headless chicken mode and going, oh my God, there's no property to buy, and mortgage rates are going up, and interest rates are shifting and everything else. And it's like, still deals to do. People are still doing deals. And it's like, while you're running around as a headless chicken, there's someone else with their head screwed on picking up all the deals that you're missing out on. And I think already, I mean, we're recording this at the end of November, and already interest rates are coming back down again. So this past week, we've had emails pretty much every day from mortgage lenders going, right, we're dropping our rates. And don't get me wrong, they're not dropping them by anything significant. They're only dropping them by probably 0.25%. But at the minute, 0.25% drop is a massive, massive difference compared to them being hiked up 3-4%, which they were sort of a few weeks ago. And who knows where we're going to be kind of end of first quarter of 2023. But the fact that rates are coming down already is a massive, massive bonus.
That must have been a hard conversation when, you know, people come to you and then you kind of have to present, you know, back kind of a few weeks ago where the market was in a terrible shape and you had to say, well, these are the rates that are out there right now. What do you want to do? That must have been a tough conversation for some of your clients.
An incredibly difficult conversation because the rate that it was changing as well, it was literally someone would come to us in the morning and say, right, I've got this buy to let, I want to go do, and we'd quote, okay, yeah, that's going to be, at current rates, that's going to be 3.5-4%. And then the afternoon would come and it'd be like, oh, it's closer to 4 now. And then the next day comes, oh, it's kind of early 4s now. And it's like, the problem is people have this tendency to take it out on the broker as if we have any control over what rates are.
Yeah, shoot, the messenger, isn't it?
It is massively, and it's the same with solicitors as well. Like, you'll always have a go at your solicitor for the fact that the searches have been delayed. So they've got no impact on how long a search takes to come back, but it's always the solicitor's fault. And it's the same with the brokers. Like, it's always our fault that interest rates have gone up. We've got no control. I mean, I have no communication with the Bank of England. I have no idea. I'm not an advisor. I'm not going, oh yeah, you should put rates up 0.25%, or yeah, you should put rates up 0.5%. But for some reason, it's always the broker's fault. So it has been an incredibly difficult, probably 6 months now, where we're kind of having to manage those expectations. But the biggest difficulty actually isn't interest rates at all. It's actually the length of time deals are taking to get through now. That is the, without a shadow of a doubt, like, people can live with interest rates. If I tell someone the interest rate's gone up 0.5%, they can kind of manage that. They manage their own expectations. They either do the deal or they don't do the deal. But to turn around to a client and say, on a deal they've already spent 20, 30, 40 grand on, and go, oh, by the way, your solicitor's really slow, or, oh, by the way, the lender solicitor's really slow, you're going to be another 3 months till completion. And they turn around and go, well, this deal's costing me £800 a day, or we've got one at the minute where it's costing £2,500 interest a day. And it's like another 3 month delay. And it's like, this is getting into some serious money. I mean, that's nearly £200,000 over those 3 months. It's a really, really difficult conversation on delays. I mean, like I said, the interest rate conversation is easy enough to have. But the delays are the things that are killing most deals at the minute, and are just putting people off wanting to proceed with anything.
Well, it just goes to show time is money, right?
Oh, 100%. I mean, when you hear someone's paying £2,500 a day in interest, and you're like, they need to sort something out pretty quickly. Yeah, I mean, luckily the portfolio is a substantial portfolio, but even still, £2,500 a day is a hell of a lot of money.
So with the impacts, what we've just discussed there is what's happened so far. What is your view in terms of next year, and where do you think the market will be?
So from my perspective, I think we'll cap out at 4%. I think the base rate will cap out at 4%. I mean, obviously I haven't got a crystal ball, so this is kind of all just personal opinion, but I think we'll cap out at 4%. And I think we'll see a lot more support moving into next year. I can't remember when the next general election is. I think it's early 2024. The Conservatives have got to do something. They're fighting for voters by the day. Ironically, they can win more voters in I'm a Celeb than they can in the polls at the minute. So it's one of those things where I think they're going to have to throw something at it to get these rates down, because otherwise it's just going to be a landslide Labour victory. And so I think from a market, I think we're going to see a lot of support as we move into next year. But the problem is all this support costs money, and where's that money going to come from and everything else. So I think we'll see a cooling off of house prices. I think that's inevitable. We're already starting to see it. And I think that mainly is going to be driven by the fact that rents are obviously going to have to go up to cover increased mortgage payments. I can't see house prices continuing as they are, it won't be affordable based on current interest rates. And that's where I think that cap of 4% will come in. And then I think late next year, we'll probably see that start to come down again, hopefully, or maybe early 2024. But I think we're through the worst of it, in my personal opinion.
Yeah. It's interesting to know, because obviously, you're somebody that's on the front line. You deal with finance, you deal with lenders on a daily basis. So you kind of get to see maybe a certain inside behind the envelope than other people sometimes.
Yeah.
So it was, interesting to hear your thoughts. I was reading one of the Savills reports, and they're saying that they think prices are going to fall by 10%, which was essentially just bring us back in line to Jan 2022 time.
Yeah.
So there will be a slight dip from what they're saying, but it won't be anything true significant. I think because 2008 has kind of set a precedent of the skies falling and these things happen, I think people, as soon as there's a bad time on the horizon, because things have been so good, you know, we've had double digit increases over the last 2 years throughout COVID, which is supposed to be one of the craziest, toughest times, etc. And I think people kind of thought, you know, the party's over and we're now going to be heading for another 2008. Will we, won't we? Like you said, we don't have a crystal ball, so it'll be interesting to sit back and watch. But equally, while people are setting their hands, sitting back and waiting, other people are doing deals. And sometimes those deals can be very lucrative, let's say, because the market shifted, less people, less competition. So sometimes people can be a bit more aggressive on their terms.
Yeah, exactly that. And I think that's where people are going to really succeed over this next 12, 18 months, is picking up deals that other people don't want to do. And I think you're right about the precedent being set now. I think everyone panicked. Obviously, 2008 was horrific, and people now panic if we get anywhere near that again. And I think that's where the support will come in, is to ensure that we never, ever see a time like that ever again. Fingers crossed, there'll be some good support come in early next year, and hopefully this cost of living crisis under control and everything else, hopefully it'll start to ease some of the burdens and pressure that people have got. But it'd be interesting to see what early next year brings.
Yeah, good stuff. Obviously, let's go back to the 40-unit scheme you mentioned. Obviously, my background's in development. It's kind of the area that I enjoy most. So selfishly, I want to cover that a bit more. So 40, 42 units. So did you say that it's got outline already, or it's currently in for outline? And run me through a bit more of the process as to, again, for our audience members, dealing with maybe the affordable element. It'd be interesting to know kind of what percentage of affordable. Did you kind of argue that with the council, and kind of your unit mix and your end customer? And yeah, just kind of give us a bit more background around all that. And was there kind of any key learnings from you? Because doing a scheme of that size, you start to kind of, there's a few more moving pieces, let's say, than a scheme of one unit, two units. So I'd be interested to hear kind of your learnings, and is there kind of any advice that you'd give to people looking to do developments or land promotion opportunities of this sort of size and scale?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the first thing, obviously, is it's a massive scheme. Like, if I wasn't JVing with them, there's no way I'd be able to finance it, because it's such a step up from kind of what I've dealt with before. So that's kind of the first bit of advice I'd give, is kind of keep to your level, know your level. In terms of where it's at, it's got full planning. So that it came with full planning. They went and obtained the full planning themselves. So they obtained the land through a land swap. So what they do is they basically pick up back gardens, side plots, everything else. This is quite a sizable plot for them. But they picked it up, took it through planning, and then at that point kind of sit on it. They've realized all of their kind of value in it at that point. But for them, what happened is, how they obtained it was that they had, I think it was two or three back garden plots that another developer wanted, which equated to, I think, a fairly similar sort of number of units. So it was one of those things of this plot of land was worth probably a bit more than what these other plots were worth, but these were better placed. I think there was also some sort of ransom strip in there as well for a development that he was doing to the rear of them. So it's kind of like, it made sense for him to take those on, continue his development through, but also kind of gain this access way as well. So they did this land swap, which is now resulted in them having this plot of land. They've gone and got full planning for 40 units. They're now going in for amended planning to take it to 42 or 43, depending on whether or not the council's happy for it. In terms of affordable, there's 12 affordable units at the minute. That's going to hopefully be argued down to 9, just because if it's 12, it's horrific. It really, really eats into the profit. So hopefully we can get that down from 12 to 9. I haven't had massive amount to do with that, to be fair, other than kind of seeing a bit of paperwork now and again. They've kind of run that and dealt with it. Again, another benefit of dealing with someone who kind of sits on the developer and contractor side is I just kind of come in when there's anything finance related. I kind of leave everything else to them and they kind of deal with it. But I know that the affordable is being argued at the minute just because it just doesn't work. Yeah. So 30% of the units as affordable is just insane. I don't think there was a sell payment on this one. I'd have to check back over
what
the figures and
see. What they'll usually do is kind of a viability report, right? So they'll say...
they've had to do the viability,
this is the final value, this is, and then this is...
Well, we had to do it with the lender.
Going at this rate, it puts us below.
Yeah, we had to do it with the lender as well, because so when they were in their viability report, we went to a lender and said, right, okay, what terms can you offer on the basis of 12 of them being affordable? And it was like the lending stuff was coming back, and once you built in the interest and everything else, it just wasn't viable. So it was kind of a nice little bit of evidence to put in to go, well, actually, look, we've taken this to a lender. It doesn't stack up. It's not going to stack up for anyone. Like, they own the land unencumbered, and it still doesn't stack up. So try selling it to someone else who needs to go and get finance, and it's just not going to work. So we had to put a fair bit of paperwork together for that. But yeah, that hopefully should be done. Again, I'm looking at the dates now, but hopefully early next year. And then we expect kind of planning to be through middle of next year, I would imagine. It's not going to be a quick process.
It's super exciting. Again, it goes back to what we were saying again about kind of this long-term view, and you've kind of got this nice consistent cash flow coming in, but then you said you could be potentially set to make a £1 million profit on this deal. And
fingers crossed, yeah.
That might take 2 years, 3 years by the time you've got planning, by the time you've started on site, by the time you've completed the units and sold them, etc. Then this could be a two-year project or what have you. But it's nice to have that goal or that kind of carrot 2 years away and something to look forward to, right?
Well, that's it. And the thing is, we'll get paid on the development finance for this as well, which we stand to make probably 70, 80 grand, I would think, in terms of the development fund, because we need to borrow about 7 million. So stand to make about 70 grand, let's say. So that will be a nice little ticker over for the next kind of couple of years. So that's the nice thing as well, is I think when people get into these kind of deals, you've got to find a way of getting yourself paid even a bit earlier on when you get into these JVs, because otherwise, yeah, having to wait 2-3 years, okay, yeah, it's £1 million, who wouldn't want to wait 2-3 years for £1 million? But even still having to kind of wait for that, it's like, come on. And if something goes wrong, that million all of a sudden becomes 500 grand, or it becomes 100 grand, or it becomes like a hell of a lot less. Whereas if I've been paid the 70 grand, I kind of feel like I've had my bit out of the deal. If that £1 million didn't turn up, I'd still be saying, like, you know what, I've done all right out of this.
So you made a bit of money at the front end, and then it's kind of a nice cherry on top for you, is the way you're looking at it.
That's it, yeah. And the thing is if you never expect, you're never disappointed, are you? So it's kind of, from my perspective, I'm imagining that it will fall through and that I'll never get that cash, as in like that end bit of money, because I can't rely on it. I can't go and spend it before it comes in, because the market could crash. There could be something. And I think at least if I've made that bit of cash up front, much like a sourcer would, like sourcers, they're obviously making a bit of cash up front. It's just a much better business model, I think. It just allows you to kind of get that little bit in up front and, yeah, just be comfy in the knowledge that you've got something out of the deal.
That comes back to the age-old adage, was it a bird in the hand is better than five in the bush, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's it. As long as we've made something out of it early, then, yeah, it's well worth it.
So run me through then a little bit, just for some for our experienced listeners, and then some that are, you know, stepping into this, really interested, want to know more, want to listen to these podcasts, to listen to experienced individuals such as yourself. So run us through a little bit around kind of the differences and the pros and cons of development finance, and then we'll talk about kind of bridging finance, and then perhaps the valuations of HMOs. We'll kind of go a bit more into the technical intricacies.
Yeah, no worries. So in terms of development finance, I mean, pros and cons, fairly simple. The pro is that you can leverage up, without a shadow of a doubt. It's the way to normally you can borrow kind of 60-70% of your purchase, 100% of your build cost. So from that perspective, it's a really, really nice way of kind of leveraging up and being able to do lots of deals at the same time. The con of development finance is that it's released in arrears. So you've still got to have that cash flow to kind of cover you to get you through the stages. That's kind of the main pro and the main con of that. In terms of, I'd say one of the other pros of development finance, it's not as expensive as people think it is, because you're only ever paying interest on what you draw down. So a lot of the time it ends up actually being cheaper than you'd expect. And it actually, in most circumstances, tends to be cheaper than a private investor once you've kind of worked all the numbers out. Because development finance, you're only paying interest on what you draw down, you draw it down in tranches, in arrears, etc. So your interest cost tends to be less than a private investor who whacks the whole amount in a bank account and goes, right, pay me 10% on that full amount for the next year. So from that perspective, it does end up kind of working out a little bit cheaper.
Just for my understanding for other people just listening, yeah. So what you're essentially saying there is, if you needed £1 million, for instance, if you get it from a private investor, they'd give you the £1 million and you'd pay them 8%, 10%, what have you, per annum on that £1 million. And that is kind of from day one what you're paying per those 12 months. But if you were to do it from development finance, because you get that payment in tranches, you would get kind of 200 grand at the beginning. So you'd pay 8% on that 200 grand. Yeah. Then you'd get another 200 grand, so 400 grand total. So then you'd pay so then it's basically that delayed payment, just for people kind of listening in. So you don't pay it all up front, pay it in slow kind of tranches. So what is supposed to be kind of 8%, 10% per annum might actually work out less than that based on the time that you're bringing that money into your account.
Absolutely. I mean, if you had a development lender at 10% and a private investor at 10%, you'd probably end up paying the development lender 6-7% once you kind of work it all out at the end. You're still paying the private investor 10%. So on £100,000, on £1 million, it's working out as essentially like £40,000 saving to go with development finance. And obviously you've got to weigh it all up with the arrangement fees and everything else, because there's different fees obviously for development finance than there is an investor. So you've got to weigh it all up kind of side by side. But a lot of people think, private investors easier to deal with, easier to kind of get stuff over the line with, or cheaper, etc. But it sometimes isn't always the case. When it comes to bridging finance, many of the pros and cons are exactly the same. The biggest con of bridging finance is that it can be very, very expensive. It's as simple as that. It is probably one of the most expensive products available. And it's also probably one of the most aggressive as well. So in terms of repossessions, in terms of when things go wrong, probably the most aggressive one that's out there. So realistically, if you're getting into stuff for the first time, development finance is great. It's a easier product to deal with. The repossession rate is much lower. Development lenders tend to want to work with you rather than against you. Whereas on bridging finance, if you're new to it, it can be very, very daunting. So I would just say, if you're getting into bridging finance for the first time, if you're doing refurbs or if you're doing flips or something that requires a bridging loan, just make sure that you fully understand the repercussions if something goes wrong, because especially on bridging finance, they can be pretty intense. And that's without a shadow of that, the biggest con of bridging finance is just that worry that if everything goes wrong, they're going to take the place off you. But in terms of pros, I mean, you can borrow against market value rather than purchase price. You can borrow on properties that are unmortgageable. You can pretty much do anything on a bridging loan. There's not much you can't do with it. So from that perspective, it's a great product to have. And then moving on to HMO valuations, the bane of my life, an HMO valuation. But realistically, HMO valuation, you're only ever going to get an HMO valued commercially if the valuer is going to go out, look at it and say, yeah, that can't be a family home. So it needs to be kind of 6 bedrooms plus. It needs to be en suites. It needs to probably even have C4 planning use. It needs to be sui generis. Because if you can get C4 planning usage on it, so if you're in an Article 4 area, for example, it makes it much more difficult for a valuer to say, oh yeah, this could be a family home, because it can't be, because if they wanted to move into it, they'd have to go get planning to change it back to C3. So from that perspective, HMO valuations, a lot of people come to us with 4-bed HMOs and go, oh, right, I want a commercial valuation on this. So it's never going to happen. Never going to happen. A valuer is going to go out, he's going to look at it and go, all you've done is you converted the living room into a bedroom. Any family could come and buy that and convert it back into a living room because you've not done anything major to it. If someone came to us with a 4-bed HMO, all 4 bedrooms are en-suited, chances are the valuer is going to look at it and go, okay, actually, you know what? a family isn't going to want to move into this because they're going to have to rip ensuites out of the living room, they're going to have to do readjustments, etc., then potentially you might get a hybrid valuation, which is essentially a bricks and mortar valuation, but with the valuer going, okay, actually, there's a bit of commercial element to this as well, and kind of giving you a little uplift in respect to that. But there's no set formula to any of this. It's ridiculous. You speak to any valuer and you go, okay, how are you valuing an HMO? Oh, well, I'll just do a yield-based valuation. Okay, but what are you basing that off? Is it an actual yield? Is it a comparable yield? Are you going out and just saying, oh, well, we're going to assign this yield to it? And it's like, there doesn't seem to be any kind of rhyme or reason to what they're doing. They kind of go out and go, right, it's a 7-bed HMO. We think it's commercial. We think it's a 10 times multiplier. So because it's a 10 times multiplier, we're going to give it a yield that obviously gives them that 10 times multiplier. They don't go out and actually work out a yield like you and I would. So it's tends to be based off of multiplier rather than anything else, much like when they value proper commercial assets and things like that. But anyway,
well, it doesn't seem like an exact science there. So there's bias in there. Each value is different. Have you found some lenders are more lenient to certain valuations than others? Are there some that you kind of recommend to clients, or is the market a whole just pretty similar?
I'd say there's definitely lenders who are more commercially minded. So there are, yeah, sure. You have to be very, very careful because certain lenders will instruct their valuers in different ways. So we have to go to lenders that are going to instruct them as commercial valuations. One of the biggest ones is Shawbrook. They're very, very good when it comes to commercial valuations. However, it was, I don't know whether they've changed the process now or not. It's been a while since we've done one through them, but there used to be a way of, they would let the broker decide what kind of valuation it was going to be. So it left it down to user error. If we click commercial valuation or if we click hybrid valuation, it's up to us what the value is kind of being instructed on. And if we get that wrong, it can lead to some major issues. So from that perspective, yeah, we're always trying to aim clients in the direction of lenders who are more commercially minded rather than banks and building societies who are, they're only ever going to value on bricks and mortar.
That makes sense. So I guess there, what you said, you mentioned kind of Article 4. So again, if you kind of had a license in an Article 4 area, you can say, well, we've got a license. This is clearly a HMO, therefore we want a commercial valuation. Da, 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 da. And again, that makes life easier. Out of interest, say it was a 4-bed HMO and it got on a, they said, no, we're only going to do it on the bricks and mortar. So you got on done on the bricks and mortar. You made it work. Yeah. But then you then three years go by, and you then got 2-3 years worth of books showing it's a HMO and you've kind of got that income coming in and you can kind of show that. Is that another kind of strength to being able
doesn't,
to then getting a HMO valuation?
No, it doesn't make any difference
really
at all. Same with service accommodation. All it does is it benefits you from an affordability perspective. It just means that you can use it when you're talking to the lender and they run their affordability calculations. They may, and it's a big may run those calculations based on HMO or SA income rather than AST income. But from a valuer's perspective, if they've deemed it bricks and mortar, chances are they'll never change their mind. And when it comes to the license bit that you mentioned a second ago, so Article 4 is only obviously relevant to the planning element of it. The licensing comes in like selective licensing areas and stuff like that. A license makes no difference to your valuation. That's what we've realized with valuers recently. If you've got a license, it makes no difference to them whatsoever. Because the license is just obviously a council's requirement for whether they have mandatory licensing, selective licensing, or whether you just fall into the national standard of licensing. It makes no difference to the valuation whatsoever. We've had unlicensed HMOs, we've had licensed HMOs, and the valuations have come back exactly the same. It's only it's the planning element that has a massive, massive impact. If it's got planning, you'd be pretty much guaranteed a commercial valuation.
Okay. So your advice there then is kind of planning is the key thing. Is there any other kind of tips or tricks you'd give people to assist with valuations? I know that sometimes people will do kind of those valuation decks, won't they, which they'll give the valuer. Does that make a difference from your experience? Or again, not really, if you kind of say there's three other HMOs in the street, this is what they've been valued at.
Yeah, it can help at times, especially with comparables, because we've had ones where we've had HMOs being valued in Northampton and they're using comparables in Leicester. And you're like, does that make any sense? Like, why are you going that far away? So those decks can help from a comparables perspective, but we've not realized or not noticed any impact on valuation with them. like they've not improved valuations, they've not decreased valuations. So we've not really noticed any benefit of it from that perspective, but it is beneficial when it comes to comparables, absolutely. The key tip that I would give everyone though, if they're going for an HMO valuation, is just keep it as far away as humanly possible from a family home. If you can do that, then chances are you'll get a better valuation.
I've seen somewhere where people put those kind of keypad locks on the doors for each one, and they'll have a number, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, etc., trying to look, make it look a bit more kind of hotel room-esque, I guess. And again, you can say, well, you don't get that in a family home. This is quite clearly a bespoke HMO, etc.
Yeah, I mean, the valuer's comment back to that is it doesn't cost anything to remove those locks and those numbers on the doors. So it wouldn't necessarily give a better valuation, but actually from it, still visually, it's good to have those things, because when the valuer goes round it, they get that feel of, I'm not in a family home, I'm in an HMO. I think where it's difficult is where they walk in and literally there's a bed in the front room, and it's like, oh, I want a commercial HMO. So you've put a bed in the front room. Like, you haven't even got a lock on the door. It's just a bed in the front room. We've had that a couple of times. But yeah, it's just about trying to make it as far away from a family home as possible.
Interesting. So do you do any kind of serviced accommodation values as well, or, and financing for that, or not really?
We don't do a huge amount. I mean, we do a bit of financing. It just falls under standard mortgages these days, really, because lenders are becoming more kind of used to it. But from an SA perspective, there's no special valuations, because all you're doing is, rather than letting your flat out month by month, you're letting it out night by night. It doesn't have any impact on the valuation unless you run it for 2, 3, 4 years, and then you might get a business valuation rather than a sort of bricks and mortar valuation. But actually, 9 times out of 10, that business valuation is worse than the bricks and mortar valuation anyway, because the multiplier they use is much lower on a business valuation than on a commercial valuation. So yeah, from an SA, so there seems to be this myth that lenders go out and put massive, great big sort of premiums on SA properties, and they don't at all. Because if they have to repossess it, they're going to sell it as a house. They're not going to sell it as a SA unit. And it's the same with HMOs as well. It's if it's repossessed, they'll either sell it as a family home or they'll sell it as an investment. If they believe that they can sell it as an investment, you'll get a commercial valuation.
Sure. Again, that all makes sense. At the end of the day, it comes down to the lender and the funding, the banks, etc., to cover their arse.
Absolutely.
By doing this, you're able to essentially make their life easier. So it comes down to good planning for when you're trying to get these valuations in. If you do nothing but put a bed in the front room, like you just said, and say, can we have
can't
this?
Be expecting a commercial valuation.
When you put yourself in the valuer's shoes, well, he has the higher ups to contend with. And if the higher ups go, Dave, come in here, why have you put a commercial valuation on this? He's then has to try and argue his case to his director. And as soon as you kind of look at it from that point of view, I find sometimes property investors can get a bit overzealous with what they're hoping to achieve. And actually, when you kind of say, well, imagine being the valuer's perspective, imagine the valuer's director's perspective, and how it all kind of rolls down here, they go, oh, okay, that makes more sense. Let me try do this and this to try and enhance my chances or kind of mitigate the risk of not getting that sort of valuation that I'm hoping to achieve. So just going back to bridging then. So as you kind of said, it's quite an aggressive thing. Obviously, it's a lot of people will use it for auctions, for raising finance that way. So it does have the benefits of being faster, more flexible than kind of your typical mortgage. What people tend to do is with the flips, they'll use private finance and bridge, or kind of a hybrid, a mix of the two, or one or the other, to then kind of purchase the property. And then within 6 months, I then go through that valuation of the buy to let. But you've kind of said there the negatives as well. So if you don't, if kind of market shifts, you don't hit that, and you might have to leave money in. Or equally, if you don't kind of come through with the goods, you said that they can be quite aggressive in terms of coming after you in repossession. So is there anything that kind of first time investors or anybody kind of stepping into the market, maybe they're experienced, but they've done a lot of stuff with their own money, and they're now looking to grow and scale and maybe exploring opportunities of using other finance, maybe if good deals come to them and their finances company or their own personal money's tucked up in other deals and they want to use bridging finance, for instance? Is there kind of any advice that you can give to them from what you've seen? Because I can imagine, obviously, through your experience, you've done a lot of deals and you've seen the good, the bad and the ugly, right?
Yeah, exactly that. I mean, there's only one point I'd really make, And there's only one point that people need to keep in mind, and that's communication. I'd say the only time I've ever seen bridging deals collapse or repossessions start to come into play is where communication stops between the client and the lender. It's as simple as that. Just keep communication up. If you keep talking to them, they'll work with you. They'll try their best to keep, they don't want to go down that path. It doesn't look good on them. It costs them money, but they don't want to get into that. So the biggest thing I would say is just keep that line of communication open. Other than that, there's not much else to worry about when it comes to bridging. It really is just, when it comes to all commercial finance, as long as you keep communicating, it's people dealing with people. It's not people dealing with computers. And keeping that communication is the one single way to keep that property in your possession. It's as simple as that, really. I think that's my main point. If everyone forgets everything else that I've said during this, I would say communication is the one bit to take away from it. Just keep that line of communication open.
I think that's really important as well. You see it time and time again where people will avoid difficult conversations, let's say, or things aren't going right, and it's easy to kind of bury your head in the sand. But burying your head in the sand, the issue isn't going away. Actually, it comes, the situation actually can only get improved by that good communication. So look, this has happened, how can we address it? And again, you're usually talking and working with experienced individuals who will be able to give you option A, B and C, and it's their incentive to support you and assist you as well. They're not just gonna come straight after you. These are all human beings at the end of the day, and they all want to work with people. And again, if you kind of work together and find a solution, then you're more likely to use them again. So again, it's
exactly
what I go back to, this 5-10 year long-term view of working together and supporting each other. So yeah, I think that's obviously a key part.
Absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt.
So I guess that kind of comes to the end, really, in terms of, we've covered development finance, we've covered bridging, we've kind of gone through your story. Your entire life story. So perhaps one of the last things is, what's kind of your vision for the next 2, 3, 5 years? So are you going to continue to grow your business, or are you going to kind of hold on to what you've got currently in terms of keeping it lean, as you said earlier? And are there kind of other developments that you're looking at doing? It'd be interesting to hear your view, really.
Yeah. So kind of the plan moving forward is get myself back out there. That's the number one thing at the minute, is get back out there, get my feet back on the ground in terms of public speaking and everything else. Probably going to explore the education arm as well. I think there's a bit of a lack of education when it comes to this stuff. So it's a difficult one because people have this viewpoint of, I just go to a broker, why would I pay to go and sit on a course to do it? I just pay you to do it. And it's like, well, actually, it's good to have these fundamental skills and knowledge actually for when you're negotiating deals. It's not about trying to raise the money, kind of that side of things. It's more about how to structure stuff creatively, I guess. So I'd love to explore that side. But in terms of the business, I would love to see it grow. And not in terms of staff base, I want to keep the staff base as it is, but it'd be nice to kind of grow our client base a bit more, I think. Get a few more developers on the books, and just be able to keep delivering a great service to people. And I think, I can't see me hanging my boots up anytime soon. So I think for me, it's the commercial finance brokerage. They don't sell because there's no residual income or anything. They're not worth anything. So this isn't a build it up and sell it plan or anything like this. Like I'm in this for as long as I can keep doing it. So from my perspective, I'd love to keep growing kind of the client base, and then get my feet back on the ground.
Nice. Although you've got about 8 children, you're far too young to be
exactly
holding your hat up just yet.
Yeah, I've got a few more years left in me yet, mate.
No, good stuff. Well, I appreciate your time. I know that you're a busy man, so I'm glad that you came on and kind of shared with the audience your background and what you've done. If there's kind of people out there that want to reach out to you, perhaps they're working a few deals and want to reach out to the Property Finance Collective, what's the best way to do so?
Yeah, just search the Property Finance Collective, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn. You'll find a way of connecting with us. But I'd say the website, propertyfinancecollective.co.uk, is probably the best way to make contact.
Well, thank you very much, Michael Primrose.
Amazing. Cheers, mate. Thank you very much for having me on.
Cheers.